Hare Krishna. What are we supposed to do before Chaitanya Charitamrita class in terms of kirtan? What do you normally do? Jai Radha Madhava. Okay. Did you know in the beginning of the movement there was no Bhagavatam class? Did you know that? You want to know why there was no Bhagavatam class? Because nobody even understood the Bhagavatam. And nobody read it. It was a book on a shelf for most devotees. And then one day, it was announced, this was probably March or April of 1970, that one newly initiated devotee, who was initiated a few months earlier, was quite intelligent and a scholar. He was the only one who was reading Bhagavatam. Otherwise, for us, it was Bhagavad Gita morning and evening. And he had cracked the code of Bhagavatam. He actually understood it. And it was announced he's going to give Bhagavatam class, which was amazingly exciting news for us because Bhagavatam was a mystery. And that devotee's name was Hridayananda Das Brahmachari. He was the only one who had the intelligence to read it and understand it. And so my first Bhagavatam class was about 4 or 5 months after I joined. That was a rare occasion. And later on, Prabhupada officially established the Bhagavatam class in the morning. And what had happened was, our movement at that time, our prime activity was Sankirtan, Harinam Sankirtan. And the way it would work is that one or two people would stay back at the temple for deity worship and cooking, and everyone else would go. And so in the morning, we did all the duties, the cleaning and so forth, and the whole temple was gone all day on Sankirtan. So the schedule was normally on the weekdays, maybe we would go out all day and then come back in the evening for a class and then go back after the class out till 10, 11, or 12, and then on the weekends go back out till 12, 11, or no, to 12 or 1. So that was kind of normal. On the day I was initiated, I went to sleep at 2 a.m. because we were on Harinam. I woke up at 8 o'clock, got ready, and got my initiation. No rounds chanted like that. So that was like schedule. And then there were some problems in the movement. And Prabhupada said, no more late night Sankirtan, and everyone should go to Mangalartik, because there was no Mangalartik other than the Pujari, because we'd go to bed so late. So this Bhagavatam class was established. And then I believe it was 1971. Well, Prabhupada established it with the chanting of the mantra and like that. We didn't do that before. Then in 1971, he introduced Jai Radha Madhava, as far as I understand, in Gorakhpur in India. That was the first time we heard it. And then that became standardized. Did you know that? I was thinking today, I would like to engage the verses we're reading in a way that you can learn ISKCON history, because I think it's quite interesting. Yeah, then one time Prabhupada said, we're chanting these shlokas every day, because he introduced it, the chanting of the verse in Bhagavatam, so he had to explain what we're doing. We're introducing this so you will memorize. So he expected we would, by reciting 10 times, memorize the verses. That was part of it. And also learn the pronunciation. Yes, so can I tell you about the Govinda prayers? When I was first coming to the temple in the fall of 1969, and every morning we had Bhagavad Gita class because nobody knew Bhagavatam. And Prabhupada hadn't established that. But what he established was that every morning before Bhagavatam, we chanted the Brahma Samhita, a few shlokas. That was just what we did. That was somehow where Prabhupada had us do that. And Prabhupada had said, Lord Chaitanya chanted this every day, so that became a standard. So when the devotees here made the Govinda prayers, and Prabhupada said, play it every morning, we were already chanting every morning Govinda. That was just what we did, somehow or other, that was established. So when Prabhupada heard the Govinda prayers, as some of you know, Prabhupada was choked up and crying, and then he said, play it in the temple every day. So that's the history of the Govinda prayer. We were actually chanting before that. It wasn't like they made it and he established a new standard. We were actually, that's what we did. And then some devotees in Los Angeles revolted against that playing of the Govinda prayers. Because if you listen carefully or you know something about the history of the recording, there are drums, there's bass guitar, there's, I think, steel guitar. Of course, there's harp. There's nice instruments, but they're the typical rock and roll instruments, bass, drums, guitar. It's in there. So that was one complaint. You know, we're listening to like kind of like rock and roll every morning, although obviously it's not rock and roll. But we had no recordings like that. But the worst thing was that these brahmacharis, they had written to Prabhupada and said, it's a woman leading the kirtan. And, we're being subjected, these poor innocent, I don't know how they said it, but, you know, the intention was, the poor innocent brahmacharis are being subjected to having to hear a woman's voice leading kirtan every morning. So that was a riot, sort of. But they had the audacity to write Prabhupada. And in Prabhupada's books, you know, we have this pastime of Lord Chaitanya hearing a woman chant, and he was in his ecstasy running to the woman. He didn't know it was a woman, to embrace her because he was so ecstatic because of her chanting, and Govinda saved him. And in the purport, Prabhupada says, a sannyasi shouldn't hear a woman singing because it's a subtle fall down. So that was the ammunition, right? So Prabhupada is very, how should we say, expert, balanced, and not disturbed by these things. And you know what he said? Who knows what he said? He said, no, there's many people chanting. It was like, he didn't give any philosophical explanation. You're a fanatic brahmachari, you know, grow up. He said, no, there are many people chanting, it's fine. It's Sankirtan, it's a whole group. Factually, I think she's leading alone. Maybe she and Shyamasundar might be leading, but basically you hear Jamuna's voice, isn't it? So it is actually a woman leading in Prabhupada. Oh, it's Sankirtan. Prabhupada liked it, he was moved by it, he felt the devotion. And there's another story where, I don't know if you know this is such an interesting story. You know, the original Krishna book had all these very simple paintings, right? They look like, you know, first-year art students or high school art student paintings. So the artists became proficient, and on their own, they redid most of the paintings. Because, you know, do we have a sample of a simple, it's kind of like, that's, you know, yeah, like these paintings are older. They're like more simple. They're not detailed like the new paintings, you know, so detailed, intricate, and Renaissance style. But these are really simple. Just, you know, take a brush and paint straight, you know, like you're painting a wall kind of. So the artists became more proficient and they started redoing all the paintings. And they brought them to Prabhupada, and one by one, he rejected, I think, every single painting. Isn't that interesting? And materially, they were all much, much better. And he'd look at one painting and you go, he would say, why do you make their hair so long? You're all hippies. You like long hair. Reject that. You know, I mean, they spent a month on the painting. Next one. Why have you done this? Reject, reject. What is wrong with the painting? The paintings that were good, why you want to change the painting? Materially, these paintings were at least 20 times better. And he rejected, I think, everyone. Maybe one he left. He accepted. And so what we understand is Prabhupada saw the bhakti in the paintings, and he also saw that the Siddhanta was perfectly executed. And in these new ones, they were like, you know, creative artists with doing whatever, and he rejected, I think, all but one or two. Isn't that interesting? He saw the bhakti. That's what he saw. He didn't see the material. So when he heard this Govinda, he wasn't thinking woman, brahmacharis. He just was feeling the devotion of all the devotees, and it communicated to Prabhupada the mood of Lord Brahma. So when Prabhupada heard it, he started crying. So then there's another story. Prabhupada never ate maha, or rarely ate maha, at least not as his main meal. But when he was in Australia, he would eat maha prasadam because the cook was so good. It was Kurma who was cooking, and he liked it so much. He just said, give me maha. So his cooks, you know, had vacation. And one day he was eating the prasadam, and he said, call Kurma up. And Kurma comes up, and he didn't say, the prasadam is delicious. He said, thank you for following the regular principles. That was his realization by eating the prasadam. Isn't that interesting? Like Prabhupada could feel bhakti, and we're looking at it externally, better paintings, and women are singing, and he feels the bhakti. So I said, thank you for following the regular principles. He said, by eating what you've cooked, I can tell that you're strictly following. Isn't that amazing? So opposite is also true, isn't it? So Prabhupada introduced Jairada Madhava and the chanting in Sanskrit. So that became a standard. And then on one or two occasions, when Prabhupada chanted this song, he said, not on one or two occasions, he said, this song is a perfect description of Vrindavan because everything is there. Radha, Madhava, in the kunjas of Vrindavan, lifting of Govardhan, Gopi Jana Balava, the beloved of the gopis are there, Mother Yasoda is there, the people of Braj are there, Jamuna is there, Krishna wandering on the Jamuna. So when Prabhupada would chant, he was going off into Vrindavan and into the Leelas of Krishna. And on one occasion, I happened to be there in Mayapur, which was, it was amazing to see. He just stopped. He was chanting, and he, as we say, I don't know if you say it here, but as we say in California, he lost it, so to speak. He lost his composure. He choked. And so nobody knew what to do. He just stopped. It was like dead silence. And then at one point, a devotee started chanting because we didn't know what to do. And it's like dead silence. What do you do when your spiritual master's in trance? And later on, the devotee who started the kirtan, he asked Prabhupada, was that the right thing to do when this happens? Or it was kind of like, did I do the right thing, and if it happens again, is this what I should do? Who knows what Prabhupada said? Prabhupada apologized. He said, I don't do it often. I'm sorry. In other words, the emotions of the pure devotee, he keeps them to himself. And externally, he appears like ordinary devotee, following Krishna consciousness. And so it happened on another occasion, and he apologized. And so Prabhupada was very careful to hide those emotions because he didn't want that to be a standard and he didn't want us to imitate. And what Prabhupada was careful about doing was setting an example of sadhana. So he would hide his emotion, but he wouldn't hide his sadhana. So Kumbh Mela or Magh Mela, I think 1971 perhaps, devotees wake up in the morning and temperature is probably like 6 or so. Very, very cold. Cold enough that nobody wanted to get up. And nobody was getting up. And Prabhupada was a little sick. And so Prabhupada saw that no one was getting up. And he wanted them to have Mangal Arati. So he got up and took a cold bath, even though he was sick, to set an example. Sometimes Prabhupada was ill, and he was too ill to give Bhagavatam class, but he would come to the Bhagavatam class, and he would sit down and he'd ask his one disciple, say, "You speak." And he would just listen. And then he would get inspired, and like halfway through the class, he would start talking, even though his energy wasn't coming from his physical platform. It was coming from the spiritual platform. And when devotees weren't following the program, then Prabhupada said, "But I'm going. You're not going, but I'm going." So he said, "Don't try to be a better Paramhansa than your guru." And his Paramhansa means you don't need to go, right? You don't need to follow. He says, "But I'm going, why you're not going?" So Prabhupada was very careful about setting an example of what we should be doing and controlling any emotions that would be misunderstood or perhaps imitated. Right? Okay, so that's the little history. Is that okay? I'll tell you another story. This is so nice. I was just thinking, there's not much in the verses and purports, so don't worry. We'll get to them, but there's not. So I wanted, I'm trying to tie in some things about Prabhupada that may be of value or interest to you and historical that you may not know. You probably know that when Prabhupada came to the West, he said, he once remarked that I was never alone. I always felt that my spiritual master was with me, right? He said, I never felt alone. Sometimes he would say, I didn't know which way to go. Should I go left? Should I go right? He said, I'm just alone here in New York. I don't know. And sometimes Prabhupada didn't have facility to cook and he was going to sleep hungry. Did you know that? That sometimes he said, I couldn't sleep because I was hungry. There was no place to cook. So he was going through a lot, as we know. So he one time he said, even though I was alone and there was so much trouble, I never felt alone. I always felt my spiritual master was with me. So in 1970... San Francisco was the only place in the world. Well, no, you had Rath Yatra. When was the first Rath Yatra here? 1969, 70? Anybody know? 71? Anyway, 73 was the first, was it? Really? Okay, so that means in 1970, San Francisco, which Prabhupada named as New Jagannath Puri, it's by the ocean, that was where the first Rath Yatra started in 1967. So still, 1970, it's the first Rath Yatra. Now, in 1970, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness had 17 centers around the world. Did you know that? Average center had, I would say, a liberal estimate, 12 devotees. Who knows what 17 times 12 comes out to? That's how many devotees were in the Hare Krishna movement. The average temple in 1970, the number of congregational members, 2 or 3. It was usually one family, right? 1 or 2 families. That was, I mean, I don't know about here, but the average temple in America didn't really have congregation. It was like just a handful of people at most. So 17 temples around the world. I looked in BTG, I think 6 of those 17 were in California. And that's where I was. And so that gives about 11 temples the rest of the world. And say we'll say 12 devotees per temple. Let's knock it up to 20 with congregation. So maybe 350 Hare Krishna devotees in the world in 1970. And in San Francisco, about 150 or 200 of them were there for Rath Yatra. So for us to see 200 devotees in one place then was phenomenal. You know, it was like, in this room is like half the Hare Krishna movement, you know, in 1970. So what happened was, devotees were coming from all over the United States, maybe some from other part of the world, and assembling there. So this was like the largest gathering to date. And in 1970, I would say 90% of the movement were brahmacharis and brahmacharinis. 90, 80, you know, pretty, yeah. 80, somewhere between 80 and 90%. All right, 75%. Mostly brahmacharis, brahmacharinis. So Prabhupada was coming. I was there. I was living in the temple. We were working like crazy to get Rath Yatra together. We would do the whole Rath Yatra in 2 weeks, which included building the cart from scratch. And average devotee slept 4 hours a day. That was just how we did it. And everybody got sick the day after. Everybody. That was the ritual. You work 2 weeks, you sleep 4 hours, and on Sunday night, you go to sleep and you wake up whenever you're better. That was just like, we accepted that. That was the mood. So we were all, you know, very enthusiastic for Rath Yatra, and Prabhupada was coming. So he came to the door of the temple, and it was a small storefront. And the temple was full of brahmacharis with freshly shaven heads and tilak and polyester dhotis. And polyester dhotis, they retained their color, so they were shiny peach. Like Gadagraj's chadar, like that color, but not a, because it was polyester, it was shiny and there were no wrinkles in it. So you had a room full of shiny-headed, shiny-dhotied. I don't think there were even enough room for women. It was like packed wall to wall. So Prabhupada came to the door and then he stopped. He didn't walk in. He just stopped and he looked. And he was smiling. And if you've ever seen Prabhupada smile, it's like, when Prabhupada smiles, it's like the sun god has descended. It's like, I've never personally, I know, maybe I'm subjectively prejudiced, but the effect of Prabhupada's smile was just heart-melting and extremely satisfying, uplifting, and other words which I don't have to describe, which have not been yet created in the English language to describe the experience of Prabhupada's smile. So there he was at the door, and he was smiling, and he was looking at all these brahmacharis. And he, like I say, this was the largest gathering, you know. Like half the movement was there, and most of them were brahmacharis. So he's just standing at the door. So why isn't he coming in? He's just looking and smiling. So he finally walks in, and he sits down on his vyasasana, and he does something that he never does when he comes to a temple. Usually comes to a temple, have some kirtan, and he'll give what we call an arrival address. He does something different. It was about noon, I particularly remember. It was around noon or 12:30. He sits on his vyasasana and he chants the Guru Vashtaka prayers to his spiritual master. So we're like, okay, whatever. We have no idea why. And basically, we're young devotees, so we don't really have any idea why anything's going on. So Prabhupada's chanting Guru Vashtaka is as confusing as wearing kopans and don't eat with your left hand and take a cold shower. It was all just confusing. So, okay, he's chanting Guru Vashtaka. That's strange, but everything in this movement is strange. It's just another strange thing. But still, we noticed it was strange. Like, why? Why is he doing that? Would you like to know why? We didn't know why, but later that day, Prabhupada revealed why. And Prabhupada said, when I came and saw all these devotees, I was so moved and impressed and inspired, I stood at the door and I called my Guru Maharaj to come see. So Prabhupada was, he calls his Guru Maharaj to come see all the devotees. And that's why Prabhupada was standing at the door. And that explains why he was chanting Guru Vashtaka. So when Prabhupada says, I never felt separated from my guru, there's your proof. He could call his Guru Maharaj. And what does Prabhupada say in the Chaitanya Charitamrita? He says, my spiritual master is always seeing my activities. So is that an amazing way to live? You feel the presence of your guru. And that's why Prabhupada could do what he did. There's a story. It's kind of a funny story. There was a young devotee. I think she was 17 when she joined. And her story of joining is so interesting. It is almost, it's like a story of a grandfather and a granddaughter. And it's almost like Prabhupada found a long-lost granddaughter and picked her up because he gave this devotee so much time and so much affection. It was so different from how he normally dealt with disciples. It was just like, this is my granddaughter. And so they had this relationship, and he would spend so much time with her, talking to her. So a few years later, she had become discouraged because ISKCON had gone from a very family-oriented movement to a very male versus female, grihastha versus brahmachari movement around early 70s, more or less 72. With the increase of brahmacharis, there was the preaching changed. So there was more emphasis on renunciation. And in order to maintain their renunciation, they were preaching about all the problems of marriage and the problems of female association and even the problems of just having the great misfortune of ending up in a female body and having even greater misfortune to be in the proximity of that female body if you're in a male body. So it changed the culture of ISKCON, and as the culture was changing, the family environment where brothers and sisters, how we used to deal with the men and women, changed to kind of like, not brothers and sisters, but kind of like enemies. So she joined at a time when it was brothers and sisters, and then she started becoming the enemy. And so she had this relation with Prabhupada where she could just kind of stomp into his room and start complaining. So she walked into his room and just said, I quit. And so she explained how the men are treating her, and she said, that's it, I quit. And Prabhupada said, you cannot quit. If anyone has a right to quit, it's me. And then he went on to explain all the troubles he faced, how he would sometimes go to bed hungry, how his Gita was stolen, how he'd live with crazy people. And especially, now she said, I'm discouraged. And he said, you have no right to be discouraged. He said, if anyone has a right to be discouraged, I do, because I didn't get anybody's help. Not one person in India helped me. And Prabhupada saying in his books, I was never discouraged because I always felt my Guru Maharaj is with me. Isn't that nice? So you feel your spiritual master with you, you won't feel discouraged. And a lot of younger devotees, when they hear the history of ISKCON and they speak to older devotees, they'll say, how is it that you could stay through these difficulties? Because you feel your spiritual master is with you, and this is what he wants you to do. And there, you know, how did Prabhupada come to America and risk his life? Because this is what his guru wanted him to do. How did so many devotees traverse the difficulties that they faced in turbulent times in our movement? Because they felt Prabhupada wants them to tolerate and stick it out and do it. And that's how they've been able to do it. Yes? So that's my introduction to Jai Radha Madhava. Okay, so we'll chant. Yes, sir. Kaushalya. Kaushalya. If you ever can listen to this story of how Kaushalya became a devotee, I don't know where I heard it. It's amazing. I wish I could remember the details, but what I remember is Prabhupada personally made her a devotee, and he gave her complete access to him, and they talked like they were just grandfather and daughter, completely informal, and And she'd say, you know, she wasn't a devotee yet, so she was interested in spirituality, but she'd say things that were not actually proper to say to Prabhupada, and he would just go along with it and just show his love and affection. It's an amazing story if you can find it. Because I think that story is unique. I've never heard a relationship like that with Prabhupada. She was 17 and living alone on the beach. So Prabhupada just grabbed her off the beach. As if, almost as if, Prabhupada knew her and knew that's what he was supposed to do. And there are stories, from my perspective, that Prabhupada knew who this person was. And was like, oh, that's you. We're back together again to spread Krishna consciousness. It seemed like that in some cases, like that kind of relationship. Yes. Is that okay? We're reading from the Adi Lila, chapter 15, and this is text 23. We'll go to text 29, and we'll chant text 29. And after some days, Jagannath Mishra passed away from this world to the transcendental world, and both mother and son were very much aggrieved in their hearts. Friends and relatives came there to pacify both Lord Chaitanya and his mother. Then Lord Chaitanya, even though he was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, executed the rituals for his dead father according to the Vedic system. So, Lord Chaitanya took sannyas, apparently, externally, from a Mayavadi. Not actually, but externally, because that was the system and that's what was accepted. Bhaktivinoda Thakur took initiation from a caste Goswami because people had criticized him that you're preaching Vaishnavism and you're not even initiated. So the only person available at that time was a caste Goswami, but it was a Vaishnav, so he took Vaishnav Diksha to be accepted. As you probably know, Prabhupada installed the deities of Krishna Balaram in a standard Murti Stapana way, which is not the way we normally do, but in order to be accepted by the residents of Vrindavan as bona fide, he adopted that. And I had the fortune of being there, and part of what was being done was that pujas were being done to Prabhupada, where they were putting dyes and on him and sandalwood and tying him with strings, and he'd have to throw rice here and there. And I was actually watching that being done to Prabhupada, and I could see from the expression on his face that he was just tolerating that because that's what people expected, and that would make our temple accepted. But you could see that he had really no interest in that. But he went along with it because that was the custom of the culture. So sometimes we will do that. And then you may know that when the devotees first went to India, at that time in the Hare Krishna movement, they went, I think, in November of 1970. So as I was saying before, at that time, the Hare Krishna movement, the only basic seva that we had, aside from a few small duties, was Harinam Sankirtan. That's what we did. So our nature, we were so accustomed to doing Harinam Sankirtan, it's like wherever we were, if there was nothing to do, that's what we would do. So the devotees had flown to India, and I think they had flown through somewhere in the Middle East that just had a war. And they got off the airplane, and they were waiting on the tarmac, and it was kind of a volatile situation, and they just did Sankirtan, and there were guns pointing at them. But that's what we did. We would just do, that was the preaching. So when the devotees went to India, they were doing Harinam Sankirtan. But they came to understand that at that time in the culture where they were, the only people that were doing Sankirtan were beggars. So the beggars would come and Hare Krishna, or shake their can or put out their hand. So people started to, you know, I guess people told us that people will think you're beggars if you do Sankirtan. So they told that to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said, stop. That was the only thing we were doing in the movement worldwide, and he stopped it. And he started a life membership program because the Harinam Sankirtan was misunderstood. Isn't that interesting? So we've heard Prabhupada say, we don't care about the culture, we don't care about people, we do it our way, they should come to our standard. You know, We have our standards, we stick to them. But we see sometimes we would have to adjust. And one time, Prabhupada was giving Bhagavatam class, I was there, and he had just spoken to a scientist. And Prabhupada told us that last night I spoke to a scientist and I called him a demon. I said, you cannot understand Krishna consciousness because you're a demon. And then Prabhupada said, and he accepted. And he just started laughing. And so then Prabhupada said, he said, I can do this. You cannot do this. You know, he's giving us a warning, you know, that, okay, people should adopt our standard, but there is a limit to what we can do. And sometimes we do adopt to their standard because it's important. So that was, you know, Vrindavan was a case. This was a case where they stopped Harinam for a time in India because it was misunderstood. So we see Mahaprabhu, he's doing also. He took sannyas in that way. He followed certain principles, brahminical life, because it was advantageous. So the point is, Prabhupada's analysis is it advantageous? Now, something amazing happened once. We had a temple that was a rented building, and that temple had been there for 7 years. And then, after 7 years, the owner of the building, of the temple, said, I'm selling the building, and unless you give me $20,000 in 1 month, then I will sell it to somebody else. So it's like, oh, we're not going to have a temple in a month, and we don't have $20,000. So, of course, the word got out to the community that we're going to lose our temple if we don't come up with $20,000, and the temple didn't have $20,000. And 20,000 showed up. And the temple president knew where that 20,000 came from. And it came from some people, I will just say this, who didn't earn it exactly in the most honest way. And in fact, they earned it by doing something to encourage the breaking of one of the regular principles. Actually, to facilitate the breaking of one of our principles. So generally, if we know the source and we know that they're accumulating money that way, we would not take it because that means we're encouraging that sin. I know some other movements will, but we would not. And sometimes when Prabhupada knew about such money, he would say, I will not touch it, it's contaminated. It's just, I don't want anything to deal with it. If they want to give it to the deities, they can, but knowingly, I cannot accept this money, knowing that I would encourage the sin that these people are committing to give the money. So the temple president, he went to Srila Prabhupada and said, this is the situation and here's the money. What do we do? And Prabhupada said, take it. So he was okay. He was happy. And they bought the building. Then later on, there was no emergency, but that same group of devotees offered money. So that same devotee went back to Prabhupada. He explained the situation, said, these devotees are making money by illegal means, by encouraging people, by facilitating people to break one of the regular principles. And they've just given a donation. Can we take it? And Prabhupada said, how can you take money that you have to take that encourages people to commit sin or to run a business that promotes sinful activity? He said, we cannot do that. He said, but Prabhupada, the last time they gave the money, you said we could accept it. And Prabhupada said, that was an emergency. We were going to lose our temple. We had to. We had no choice. So Prabhupada, sometimes very strict, sometimes very liberal, according to the situation. Yes? Oh. Laguna Beach. Then this whole, you know, then there was a moral dilemma came up. can we say things on Sankirtan that are not entirely true to sell a book? So it came to Prabhupada, because devotees were kind of sometimes not entirely, not straight, I wouldn't say lying, but not maybe as straight as we felt we should be. And Prabhupada said, I never lied. I was thoroughly honest. You learn to sell a book by preaching. That's the highest. And then one devotee, you remember did you have these, we call them gas wars, you know, there was a shortage of petrol and short, you know. So a devotee would distribute a book and say, if you read this book, this is a book about how to solve the energy crisis problem. You know, in other words, Krishna is the source of all energy, you serve him. So devotees thought, okay, he's lying. And they told Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said, no, that's just intelligent preaching. So he didn't want us to lie, but at the same time, Prabhupada was very practical, and this worked, and he didn't see it as lying. And then in one letter, Prabhupada said, Krishna is unlimited, so you can say anything about him, and it won't be a lie. So it's like, you know, he'll solve the energy shortage, you know. That's not a lie, because he's got unlimited energy. So Prabhupada was adjustable. He wasn't like only this way. Now, I'll tell another story. This is one of the funniest stories and most embarrassing, and it has to do with me, so I can tell it. This was about this principle also of adaptation to please people or not to please people. So I would like to tell you the history, at least in America, and I think probably it came over here after America, the history of devotees doing Sankirtan in Western dress, book distribution in Western dress. This became a huge controversy in our movement. And the discovery of Sankirtan in Western dress was not someone's brainstorm that the lights went off in their head that we should wear Western dress. It was because devotees were distributing books in the best places to distribute books in America, which were the malls, but they were not allowed to distribute. But because it was the best place, they would go in and try not to get caught by security, and when they got caught by security, they would leave, and then they couldn't come back. So one devotee said, well, you know, wearing a saffron dhoti and a shaved head and tilak, you know, you stand out. And all the girls had long braids. That was the program, long braids and saris. So the devotee said, well, what if we just wore wigs and Western dress? Then the security wouldn't see us. So that's what they did. And it was just to avoid the security. What do you think happened after that? They realized that when you go up to someone with a shaved head, tilak and a dhoti, not everyone stops because they know you're trying to sell them something or you just look weird and they don't want to talk to you. So book distribution basically doubled. And that was just an accident, right? So ISKCON in those days, when anything good happened, even though there was no internet, the whole ISKCON world found out about it within a week. It was just like, this book distribution is doubling. Why? Because we're wearing shirt, trousers, and wigs. And the girls are wearing, you know, nice clothes. So it came to Prabhupada. Now, this is interesting history. There's a lot of Prabhupada saids, right? Yeah, you've heard Prabhupada said. Now, Prabhupada doesn't like broccoli. We heard that because somebody cooked broccoli and they didn't know how to cook it. He didn't like it. Or Prabhupada doesn't like grapefruit because they didn't put anything sweet on the grapefruit. And I just heard another Prabhupada doesn't like oats until oats are for horses, right? In case you have a horse, that's what you feed the horse. And Prabhupada was hungry one night and they made some apple crumble or whatever you call it in your country with apple and oats. And Prabhupada like ate 1, 2, 3. Give me more. What do you call it here? Apple strudel or crumble? Give me some more of that crumble apple. Whatever, probably, you know. And it had oats in it. So Prabhupada's replies to things will depend on what's fed to him. So what was, you know, when you feed grapefruit without anything sweet, and it's not, grapefruits are generally not sweet, I don't like grapefruit, don't give me grapefruit, send that around the world until somebody put some sugar and honey and whatever, and a cherry on it, and then, this is very good, I like grapefruit. So there was a contingent who felt that wearing Western dress was a compromise of our integrity, and it was a, we were reverting to our hippie style. We don't want to wear dhoti, we don't want to wear corto or sari, we want to wear, you know, t-shirt and jeans. And the worst thing is, we're attached to hair, so we're putting on wigs because we like hair. That was what was explained to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada had this fear that his disciples would again become hippies. He definitely had this fear, and it came up. Even when he would see someone who hadn't shaved their head in 3 weeks, he'd say, hippie seeds, why aren't you, you know, brahmachari, why is your head not shaved? Hippie seeds. That's what he would say. Again, you're becoming hippies. That painting, why do they have long hair? That's your hippie tendency. He always, but you know, he had this thing like hippie samskaras again are sprouting. It came up now. So that's how it was explained to him. The Prabhupada said, no, you're again becoming hippies, right? So this is going back and forth, this discussion. And finally, the head of the BBT, he said, Prabhupada, they're dressing like ladies and gentlemen. The wigs are short hair. They're not long hair. They're not becoming hippies. He said, they're not doing this because they want to dress this way. They're doing this because it increases book distribution. But if you don't want us to distribute books, I mean, no, if you don't want us to dress this way, we will dress the other way. We're not attached. But I just want you to know, if we dress this way, if we're not allowed to dress this way, my estimation is that book distribution will decrease by 50%. Prabhupada didn't skip a beat. He said, therefore, dress this way. That was, problem was solved, right? Prabhupada's flexibility, right? Yeah, I'm not attached to the dhoti and the tilak and the korta. We're attached to the mission of Bhaktisiddhanta, which is to distribute books. So that solved the whole dilemma because it was going back and forth. And Prabhupada at one point said, no, no Western dress. Everybody said, okay. But it'll increase 50%. Yes? Yeah, that's the second part of the story. Okay, which I was personally involved in. Now, because I'm a pure devotee, only kidding, because I'm a purist, and in 1973, a pure fanatic, and think I'm smarter and better than everyone, having been raised Jewish, that is a tendency. So, and I was associating with other Jewish devotees, so that tendency was increasing by association. We decided that this whole plainclothes things was an illusion. They were under the impression they needed that to distribute more books. It was like a false belief. And we were going to dispel that false belief by wearing dhotis and saris. Well, I didn't wear a sari, but the women wore saris. Yeah. So, 1973 Christmas marathon, we were out on a mission to prove ISKCON is wrong, that it's compromised, and that you can wear dhoti, dhoti, korta, sari, choli, and you can distribute just as many books. And we did it. And we were so proud. We wrote Prabhupada a letter with the news. And the undertone of the letter was, and we didn't say this, everyone's in Maya except us, because we were the ones who were pure enough to do it, and we always knew the Western dress was wrong. And you are now going to be so proud of us, and you are going to issue a letter to the whole movement saying, Mahatma Das, Veer Krishna, Nrisimha Chaitanya, Shonapuri, this one, that one, have discovered that this whole Western dress is useless concoction. It's just in your head. You don't need to do it. They're doing just as well in dhotis, kurtas, and saris. He didn't say that. He basically said what Gadagraj said. Prabhupada smashed us. In such a polite way, it was hilarious. Prabhupada said, if you feel more comfortable in a dhoti or a sari, you can wear that. Which normally you would say, if you feel more comfortable in suit and pants, or, wouldn't it be? But you know, Prabhupada, can I wear Western dress? If you feel more comfortable, you can. Then he's, if you feel more comfortable in a dhoti and sari, you know, we're waiting for this glorious letter You've discovered there was a contamination in our movement. You've purified ISKCON. If you feel more comfortable in a dhoti and sari, you can wear that. They're completely detached, not on a mission, right? Yes? Now there's another story. It's also interesting about Prabhupada's flexibility and attachment to principle. One attachment to principle Prabhupada had was he would do anything to avoid factions in ISKCON. It was very important because his spiritual master's movement had divided. And wherever there was division, Prabhupada would always patch it together. So there was a division in our movement in 1976, and it was brahmacharis against grihasthas and traveling brahmacharis against temple brahmacharis, in the sense that if you're a temple brahmachari, you should travel with us, because if you remain in the temple, you'll get married. And what could be worse than getting married? So you have to get out before it's too late, because once you get married, your life is over. And no one ever gets out of the dark well. So that was the preaching. And the bus would come up to the temple, to inspire the temple. And a few days later, when it left, where are all the brahmacharis? It was like, a lot of vacancies in the brahmachari ashram now. And so this became an epidemic problem, and it came all the way to Prabhupada. And what is so interesting about this story is that the head of that party, what's interesting about this story is that party was the biggest book distribution party in ISKCON. Nobody can compete with them. They had 6 buses, 20 vans, all brahmacharis, Radha Damodar party. And they were unstoppable, unbeatable, and it was just an amazing party. And they were making devotees also. They were stealing devotees, but they were also making devotees. And it became such a problem that it hit volcanic eruptions in Mayapur, and the temple presidents just protested. And so Prabhupada told the head of that party, "That's it. I'm taking you out of your position because you're creating such a problem." And he told Prabhupada, he said, "If you take me out of this position, the whole party will fall apart." And we all know how important book distribution is to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada said, "I don't care." Because the principle of keeping the unity in Prabhupada's mind was even more important than book distribution. And that that party fell apart within a year or so, within a year or two, and it never recuperated. And Prabhupada didn't care, because he wanted to maintain that principle. So I think that's such an interesting story. Because the leader of that party told Prabhupada directly, "This party will fall apart. I don't care. You're out." Interesting, right? So now it's time to end class, right? Or do we get a grace period because we start late, or what? 9 o'clock. Okay. Should we finish the verses? Okay, that would be a good idea. Okay. Can we not chant this verse to save time? Is that okay? Yeah, okay. So, kata dina prabhu chite korila chitan grihashtaha ilama bhebe chahi grihadharam. After some days, the Lord thought, "I did not take sannyas, and since I am remaining at home, it is my duty to act as a grihasta." Grihine vina grihadharma na hoye shobhan eti chinti vivaha korite hoila man. Without a wife, Lord Chaitanya considered, there's no meaning to householder life. Thus the Lord decided to marry. Nagriham griham ityaho grihine griha uchate tayahi sahita sarvam purushartam samashnute. Merely a house is not a home, for it is a wife who gives a home its meaning. If one lives at home with his wife, together they can fulfill all the interests of human life. Daiva ekadina prabhupadiye asite valava acharyara konya deki gangapate. One day when the Lord was coming back from school, he accidentally saw the daughter of Valabha Acharya on the way to the Ganges. Accidentally? Does that happen in Leela? Not really. Purva siddha bhava dukara udaya kurila daiva banamali gataka sachistana oila. When the Lord and Lakshmi Devi met, their relationship awakened. Having already been settled, In other words, they're already eternal associates. And coincidentally, another accident happened. The marriage maker, Vanamali, came to see Satchimata. So accidentally, Lord Chaitanya met Lakshmi Devi. And accidentally, that day or the next day, Vanamali shows up at Satchimata's house. He's a marriage maker. And you will find out in the purport who Vanamali is, which will make you realize it wasn't an accident. Vanamali Ghataka, a resident of Navadvip and a Brahmin by caste, arranged the marriage of the Lord to Lakshmi Devi. He was formerly Vishramrita, who negotiated the marriage of Lord Ramchandra, and later was the Brahmana who negotiated the marriage of Lord Krishna with Rukmini. That same Brahmana acted as the marriage maker of the Lord in Chaitanya Lila. Chaitanya Lila ki jai. So as you know, if you could make it into Chaitanya Lila, you're quite fortunate because you get special blessings and benedictions. So you'll find in Chaitanya Lila, sometimes many devotees will come, like Brahma came as Takar Haridas, Brahma wanted, you know, mercy. So Lord Chaitanya said, okay, you'll come as Takar Haridas and you'll get mercy. So everybody gets special mercy in Chaitanya Lila. And we were once having a discussion with some very senior devotees. And the question was, if in Kali Yuga people are most fallen, why did Lord Chaitanya choose to give something higher than he gave at any time? And then the Goswamis come, who are manjaris, gopis, and they write books about manjari bhav and gopi bhav and all this esoteric stuff. It seems like, wouldn't that have been better in Satyuga, where people actually have brains that work and hearts that are pure? And now you're giving it to people with impure hearts whose brains are, you know, not firing on all cylinders. Isn't it? I mean, you probably all considered the question, right? Why? Why would he do that? It doesn't make any sense. So some senior devotees, the answer they gave is, if Lord Chaitanya wants to do that, then that's what he does. That's his will, his free will, and that's what he decided to do. And then, another answer that was given, he said, well, when a wealthy man gives charity, how much does he give? 20 pounds or 2 million pounds? So if Krishna decides to give charity, and he gives according to his position, so he's very wealthy, so he's giving a lot of charity. So this Chaitanya Lila, we're so fortunate because we're given something we don't deserve. And one time in a lecture, Prabhupada said, what was going on, there was a lot of strife in the temple, and people were starting to leave. They weren't getting along. So Prabhupada said, don't ever leave. He said, because before you became a devotee, you were all rogues and demons. And he said, and now you've been elevated to the highest position. And if you leave, again, you'll become rogues and demons. Isn't that interesting? In that same lecture, Prabhupada said, this movement will spread with you or without you. But if you stay, the Lord will use you and you will get the credit. So this is Mahaprabhu's mercy, that if we're willing to be used, we'll get credit. And many times, we've been discussing in japa workshops, many times Prabhupada had said, 16 rounds, 4 regular principles, 1 life, back to Godhead. Which is amazing. And in lectures, Prabhupada said, if you follow this process, you will. He said, these were his words, just as you are seeing me face to face, you will see Krishna face to face. And you will dance with Krishna. Is that amazing? Is that amazing or is that amazing? Yeah. So, That is the mercy of Lord Chaitanya. So when Lord Chaitanya decided to be merciful, then how did he do it? It's just mercy. It's like nothing, nobody has to qualify. If you show up, you get it. If you participate, you get it. If you're willing to be used, you will be used. Now, most of the gurus in our movement 50 years ago were hippies in San Francisco, New York, the Himalayas, right? And if you were to bet your money on whether they could become gurus in the future, you probably wouldn't make a bet on it because it wouldn't seem like it, right? So if you want to understand Lord Chaitanya's mercy, the living proof of that mercy is the advanced devotees who accepted the mercy. And don't make the mistake of thinking they are special. That's the biggest mistake. I mean, we should think that our guru is special, senior devotees are special, but you're also special. What really is special is that they accepted the mercy. And the thing that is most special is the mercy. And that if you accept the mercy, you will also be special because the mercy is special. But don't think that they are special in a way that you can't be special. And how can we say this? Now you can say, Prabhu, that's offensive. My guru is special. He must have been a devotee for 100 lifetimes. All right, that may be true, and he may be special. But even if you are not special, you can also become guru because the mercy is special. And that's what's important. And if you accept the mercy, then you'll be special. And what's the proof of that? Because any time anybody tried to say to Prabhupada, you're special, you'd say, no, I'm not. I have no qualification. Prabhupada said, I have no qualification. It is all the mercy of my guru. What's the message? I don't need qualification. You don't need qualification. You need mercy. And all you have to do is learn how to accept the mercy. And you can do amazing things. Now, I had an amazing experience when I was in Nashik. 5 years ago, I ended up in Nashik. They invited me to come there. I was in Mumbai or something. And so one day when I was there, there was a lecture by Srila Prabhupada. And in the lecture, Srila Prabhupada said, you will all someday have to become guru. And when Prabhupada said that, I looked at all the devotees' faces to confirm it went like this. You could see on their face, it went like this. There's like, he's not talking to me. That's not for me. That's for people like Radhana Swami and Shivaram Swami and Niranjan. It's for them, these rare souls, brahmacharis all their lives, special yogis in their past, even yogis in this life. It's not for me. That statement went completely over everyone's head. Why? Because naturally, when we look at ourselves, we think, no way, that is an impossibility. There's no way I could become guru, which is true, but that's only half of the equation. The no way I can become guru is the foundation for you becoming guru. But by the mercy of Mahaprabhu, I could. You know, Prabhupada told us to become gurus in 1969. How would you feel if you were sitting there? How would you feel in 1977 when your name was on the list? And you've been a devotee 6 years and you were 26 years old. How would you feel? Qualified? No. What is the mood or the mentality? It's good to have the mentality I'm not qualified, but not to have the mentality that the mercy can't qualify me. That's the misunderstanding. That's not humility. That's underestimating the potency of Lord Chaitanya and your guru. So that's an important point, because I know many devotees feel, not me, there's no way. It could be guru, it could be this service, it could be that service. It's not about you. It's about the mercy. So that's how the Hare Krishna movement spread, not by people who are qualified, but by people who knew they were not qualified. And that was their power. Not knowing they're not qualified in a negative way, but knowing they're not qualified in a positive way, and that if I'm going to succeed, the mercy will do something. And I want to tell you a story, and then we can have questions. This is such an interesting story about mercy. Many of you know that there was a devotee named Triparai, who later became Triparai Swami, who was the number one book distributor in ISKCON, and he was the person responsible for opening the floodgates of book distribution in the entire world, especially in America, but it went around the world. He was the main person. And practically anyone who was inspired in book distribution was connected to him directly or indirectly. So Prabhupada called him the incarnation of book distribution. Interesting, right? Like book distribution, Shakti had descended. So I went out in Sankirtan with him once. And it was in San Diego. And San Diego is a Navy town. And the Navy gets paid every 2 weeks. So the day the Navy is paid is the best day to distribute books, because these Navy men are single and they have more. If they don't, they'll just spend the money on beer or whatever. And so Triparai Swami said, let's go to the military base. How do you get on a military base unless you have some business on the military base? It's a military base. You just go, hello, hi, I want to drive around. Oh, sure. So how do you get on? And he had such an intense desire to distribute books. It was almost like some devotees couldn't be around it. It was like he was like an arrow. I mean, that's all he thought about. It was like very, very, and he was in kind of a, you know, a very focused, serious person. So it was like you could feel his Shakti, you know. This is, so I'm driving the car. So he goes, just drive up, I'll talk to the guard. So he drives up to the guard and he says, we have some books for your library. Guard says, okay. Within 3 seconds, we're in the gate. And I looked at that and I thought, that's what happens when you have the mercy of Lord Chaitanya. It's just like the Navy base gates open for you. I mean, I was looking at that, it's going, Maharaj, you're like, you're the man, you know, like you've got Shakti. And then one more story. When I was a young devotee, I was asked to take the responsibility of being temple president. And very, very difficult service for me. I was only, I just turned 20 when I had the service, and I'd been a devotee for 8 months. And it was a temple that was out of the way, only a few devotees, nobody visited. And the devotees in the temple were kind of, what do we say, rough around the edges, you know, not refined diamonds yet. And we had no money, and it was cold weather, and I had never seen snow in my life, and now I'm living in a city with snow, which I never would have chosen to do. That was just hard all around. And I didn't want to stay, but I didn't want to give up my duty, because we had been taught that we should follow our duty. So at some point, I had to apply for some form of immigration, green card or whatever they have. This was in Canada. Because I couldn't stay, and they wanted me to be the temple president. And at that time, Americans were going to Canada to escape the draft, because if you were an American and you lived in Canada, they wouldn't draft you to Vietnam. So Americans were just piling out of young boys. And so there was no way that I could get immigration. That's what the lawyer said. He said, you're not going to get it because everybody's asking for it, and you don't have really a good reason. And I said, that's good news, because I don't want to stay here. But this would be an honorable way, rather than just calling up and saying, I'm leaving, this would be an honorable way to leave. Sorry, Prabhu, I'd love to stay here, but I didn't get my green card. So I had all the papers, I did everything I was supposed to, and then I drove out of Canada, turned around, and drove back into the border, and gave them my papers, thinking, there is absolutely no way I'm going to get the papers, because I don't have any qualification. I'm a university dropout, I don't have much money, I hardly speak French, there's no reason for me, you know, Hare Krishna temple president. And I swear, this is my memory, he came back in 3 minutes, and I thought, yeah, he looked at the papers and said, this guy's a joke, you know. He came back in 3 minutes, he goes, here's your paper, here's a stamp, welcome to Canada. I'm like, oh my God. So at that point, I had a major shift, and I understood if you're an instrument and Krishna wants you somewhere, you don't need the proper paperwork. You'll get on the military base, you'll get the immigration, whatever. If you're willing to do the service in the realization that I'm not qualified, but I'm willing to be empowered by the potency, then you all can become gurus. Don't ever say, I can't. It's the potency, it's not you. The potency can do it if you're willing. Hare Krishna.